This is not something for a movie production. The real world, Misha, is complex. It was as close as he could come to telling Alexandrov not to stray too far from his sandbox of theories and toys and into the real world of blood and consequences. Well, you are a good party man. You know what the stakes in this game are. With those words, Alexandrov told his host what was expected by the Secretariat. For Mikhail Yevgenievich, the party and its beliefs were the state, and the KGB was the sword and shield of the party. Oddly, Andropov realized, this Polish pope surely felt the same about his beliefs and his view of the world. But those beliefs weren't, strictly speaking, an ideology, were they? Well, for these purposes they might as well be, Yuri Vladimirovich told himself. My people will look at this carefully. We cannot do the impossible, Misha, but what is impossible for this agency of the Soviet state? A rhetorical question with a bloody answer. And a dangerous one. More dangerous than this academician realized. How alike they were, the KGB chairman realized. This one, comfortably sipping his brown starka, believed absolutely in an ideology which could not be proven. And he desired the death of a man who also believed things that could not be proved. What a curious state of affairs. A battle of ideas, both sets of which feared the other. Feared? What did Carol fear? Not death, certainly. His letter to Warsaw proclaimed that without words. Indeed, he cried aloud for death. He sought martyrship. Why would a man seek that? The chairman wondered briefly. To use his life or death as a weapon against his enemy. Surely he regarded both Russia and communism as enemies, one for nationalistic reasons, the other for reasons of his religious conviction. But did he fear that enemy? No. Probably not, Yuri Vladimirovich admitted to himself. That made his task harder. His was an agency that needed fear to get its way. Fear was its source of power, and a man lacking fear was a man he could not manipulate. But those whom he could not manipulate could always be killed. Who, after all, remembered much about Leon Trotsky? Few things are truly impossible. Merely difficult, the chairman belatedly agreed. So, you will look into the possibilities? He nodded cautiously. Yes, starting in the morning. And so, the processes began. Chapter 3. Explorations. Well, Jack's got his desk in London, Greer told his colleagues on the 7th floor.
Glad to hear it, Bob Ritter observed. Think he knows what to do with it?
Bob, what is it with you and Ryan? The DDI asked.
Your fair-haired boy is moving up the ladder too fast. He's gonna fall off someday, and it's gonna be a mess.
You want me to turn him into just one more ordinary desk weenie? James Greer had often enough fended off Ritter's beefs about the size and consequent power of the Intelligence Directorate. You have some burgeoning stars in your shop, too. This kid's got possibilities, and I'm going to let him run until he hits the wall.
Yeah, I can hear the splat now, the DDO grumbled.
Okay, which one of the crown jewels does he want to hand over to our British cousins?
Nothing much. The appraisal of Mikhail Suslov that the doctors up at Johns Hopkins did when they flew over to fix his eyes.
They don't have that already? Judge Moore asked. It wasn't as though it were a super-sensitive document.
I guess they never asked. Hell, Suslov won't be around much longer anyway, from what we've been seeing. The CIA had many ways to determine the health of senior Soviet officials. The most commonly used was photographs, or better yet, motion picture coverage of the people in question. The agency employed physicians, most often full professors at major medical schools, to look at the photos and diagnose their ills without getting within 4,000 miles of them. It wasn't good medicine, but it was better than nothing. Also, the American ambassador, every time he went into the Kremlin, came back to the embassy and dictated his impressions of everything he saw, however small and insignificant it might seem. Often enough, people had lobbied for putting a physician in the post of ambassador, but it had never happened. More often, direct DO operations had been aimed at collecting urine samples of important foreign statesmen, since urine was a good diagnostic source of information. It made for some unusual plumbing arrangements at Blair House, across the street from the White House, where foreign dignitaries were often quartered, plus the odd attempt to break into doctors' offices all over the world. And gossip. There was always gossip, especially over there. All of this came from the fact that a man's health played a role in his thinking and decision-making. All three men in this office had joked about hiring a gypsy or two, and observed, rightly, that it would have produced results no less accurate than they got from well-paid professional intelligence officers. At Fort Meade, Maryland, was yet another operation, codenamed Stargate, where the agency employed people who were well to the left of gypsies. It had been started mainly because the Soviets also employed such people. "How sick is he?" Moore asked. "From what I saw 3 days ago, he won't make Christmas. Acute coronary insufficiency, they say. We have a shot of him popping what looks like a nitroglycerin pill." "Not a good sign for Red Mike," James Greer concluded with Suslov's in-house nickname. "And Alexandrov replaces him?" "Some bargain," Ritter observed tersely. "I think the gypsies switched them at birth. Another true believer in the great god Marx." "We can't all be Baptists, Robert," Arthur Moore pointed out. "This came in 2 hours ago on the secure fax from London," Greer said, passing the sheets around. He'd saved the best for last. "Might be important," the DDI added. Bob Ritter was a multilingual speed reader. "Jesus." Judge Moore took his time. As a judge should, he thought. About 20 seconds later than the DDO, my goodness. A pause. "Nothing about this from our sources?" Ritter shifted in his chair. "Takes time, Arthur, and the Foleys are still settling in." "I presume we'll hear about this from Cardinal." They didn't often invoke that agent's code name. In the pantheon of CIA crown jewels, he was the Cullinan Diamond. "We should, if Ustinov talks about it, as I expect he will. If they do something about it..." "Will they, gentlemen?" the DCI asked. "They'll sure as hell think about it," Ritter opined at once. "It's a big step to take," Greer thought more soberly. "You suppose His Holiness is courting it? Not too many men walk up to the tiger, open the cage door, and then make faces at him. I'll have to show this to the president tomorrow." Moore paused for a moment's thought. His weekly meeting at the White House was set for 10 o'clock on the following morning. "The papal nuncio is out of town, isn't he?" It turned out that the others didn't know. He'd have to have that one checked out. "What would you say to him, anyway?" This was Ritter. "You have to figure that the other guys in Rome tried to talk him out of this."
"James? Kinda takes us back to Nero, doesn't it? It's almost as though he's threatening the Russians with his own death."
"Damn. Do people really think that way?"
40 years ago, you put your life on the line, James."
Greer had served his time on fleet boats in the Second World War, and often wore a miniature of his gold dolphins on the lapel of his suit coat. "Arthur, I took my chances, along with everybody else on the boat. I did not tell Toja where I was in a personal letter." The man has some serious cojones, guys, Ritter breathed. We have seen this sort of thing before. Dr. King never took a step back in his life, did he? And I suppose the KKK was as dangerous to him as the KGB is to the Pope, Moore completed the thought. Men of the cloth have a different way of looking at the world. It's called virtue, I think. He sat forward. Okay. When the president asks me about this, and for damn sure he will, what the hell do I tell him? Our Russian friends might just decide that His Holiness has lived long enough, Ritter answered. That's a hell of a big and dangerous step to take, Greer objected. Not the sort of thing a committee does. This committee might, the DDO told the DDI. There would be hell to pay, Bob. They know that. These men are chess players, not gamblers. This letter backs them into a corner. Ritter turned. Judge, I think the Pope's life might be in danger. It's much too early to say that, Greer objected. Not when you remember who's running KGB. Andropov is a party man. What loyalty he has is to that institution, damn sure not to anything we would recognize as a principle. If this frightens or merely worries them, they will think about it. The Pope has hurled down his gauntlet at their feet, gentlemen, the deputy director, operations, told the others. They just might pick it up. Has any Pope ever done this? Moore asked. Resign his post? Not that I can remember, Greer admitted. I don't even know if there's a mechanism for this. I grant you, it's one hell of a gesture. We have to assume he means it. I don't see this as a bluff. No, Judge Moore agreed. It can't be that. He's loyal to his people. He has to be. He was a parish priest once upon a time. He's christened babies, officiated at weddings. He knows these people, not as an amorphous mass. He's been there to baptize and bury them. They are his people. He probably thinks of all Poland as his own parish. Will he be loyal to them, even at the peril of his life? How can he not be? Ritter leaned forward. It's not just a question of personal courage. If he doesn't do it, the Catholic Church loses face. No, guys, he's serious as hell, and he isn't bluffing. Question is, what the hell can we do about it? Warn the Russians off? Moore wondered aloud. No chance, Ritter shot back. You know better than that, Arthur. If they set up an operation, it'll have more cutouts than anything the Mafia's ever done. How good do you suppose security is around him? Not a clue, the DCI admitted. Well, I know the Swiss guards exist with their pretty uniforms and pikes. Didn't they fight once? I think so, Greer observed. Somebody tried to kill him, and they fought a rearguard action while he skipped town. Most of them got killed, I think. Now they mostly pose for pictures and tell people where the bathroom is, probably, Ritter thought out loud. But there has to be something to what they do. The Pope is too prominent a figure not to attract the odd nutcase. The Vatican is technically a sovereign state. It has to have some of the mechanisms of a country. I suppose we could warn them. Only when we have something to warn them about. Which we don't have, do we? Greer pointed out. He knew when he sent this off that he'd be rattling a few cages. What protection he does have must be alerted already. This will get the president's attention, too. He's going to want to know more, and he's going to want options. Jesus, people, ever since he made that evil empire speech, there's been trouble across the river. If they really do something, even if we can't pin it on them, he's going to erupt like Mount St. Helens. There's damn near 100 million Catholics right here in America, and a lot of them voted for him. For his part, James Greer wondered how far out of control this might spin. Gentlemen, all we have to this point is a fax of a photocopy of a letter delivered to the government in Warsaw. We do not know for certain that it's gone to Moscow yet. We have no sign of any reaction to this from Moscow. Now, we can't tell the Russians we know about it, so we can't warn them off. We can't tip our hand in any way. We can't tell the Pope that we are concerned for the same reason. If Ivan's going to react, hopefully one of Bob's people will get us the word, and the Vatican has its own intelligence service, and we know that's pretty good. So for the moment, all we have is an interesting bit of information that is probably true, but even that is not yet confirmed. So for the moment, you think we just sit on this and think it through? Moore asked. There's nothing else we can do, Arthur. Ivan won't act very fast. He never does. Not on something with this degree of political import. Bob? Yeah, you're probably right, the DDI agreed. Still, the president needs to hear about it. It's a little thin for that, Greer cautioned. But yes, I suppose so. Mainly, he knew that not telling the president and then having something dire happen would cause all of them to seek new employment. If it goes further in Moscow, we ought to hear about it before anything drastic happens. Fine. I can tell him that, Judge Moore agreed. Mr. President, we are taking a very close look at this. That sort of thing usually worked. Moore rang his secretary and asked for some coffee to be sent in. Tomorrow at 10, they'd brief the president in the Oval Office, and then after lunch would be his weekly sit-down with the chiefs of the other services, DIA and NSA, to see what interesting things they had happening. The order should have been reversed, but that's just how things were usually scheduled. His first day at work had lingered quite a bit longer than expected before he'd been able to leave. Ed Foley was impressed by the Moscow Metro. The decorator must have been the same madman who'd designed Moscow State University's wedding cake stonework. Evidently beloved of Joe Stalin, whose personal aesthetic had run the gamut from Y to Z. It was strangely reminiscent of the Tsarist palaces, as interpreted by a terminal alcoholic. That said, the metro was superbly engineered, if somewhat clunky. More to the point, the crush of people was very agreeable to the spook. Making a brush pass or other sort of pickup from an agent would not be overly trying, so long as he kept to his training. And that was something Edward Francis Foley was good at. Mary Pat would love it here, he was sure now. The milieu for her would be like Disney World was for Eddie. The crush of people, all speaking Russian. His Russian was pretty good. Hers was literary, having learned it at her grandfather's knee, though she'd have to detune it, lest she be made as someone whose language skills were a little too good to be merely the wife of a minor embassy official. The subway worked well for him. With one station only a couple of blocks from the embassy and the other practically at their apartment house's doorstep, even the most paranoid Directorate II shadow would not find his use of it terribly suspicious, despite the well-known American love for cars. He didn't look around any more than a tourist would and thought that maybe he'd made one tail. There'd probably be more than that for the moment. He was a new embassy employee, and the Russians would want to see if he wiggled like a CIA spook. He decided to act like an innocent American abroad, which might or might not be the same thing to them. It depended on how experienced his current shadow was, and there was no telling that. For certain, he'd have a tail for a couple weeks. That was an expected annoyance. So would Mary Pat. So probably would Eddie. The Soviets were a paranoid bunch, but then he could hardly complain about that, could he? Not hardly. It was his job to crack into the deepest secrets of their country. He was the new chief of station, but he was supposed to be a stealthy one. This was one of Bob Ritter's new and more creative ideas.
Typically, the identity of the boss spook in an embassy wasn't expected to be a secret. Sooner or later, everyone got burned one way or another, either ID'd by a false flag operation or through an operational error, and that was like losing one's virginity. Once gone, it never came back. But the agency only rarely used a husband-wife team in the field, and he'd spent years building his cover. A graduate of New York's Fordham University, Ed Foley had been recruited fairly young, vetted by an FBI background check, and then gone to work for the New York Times as a reporter on a general beat. He'd turned in a few interesting stories, but not too many, and had eventually been told that while the Times wasn't going to fire him, it might be better for him to seek employment with a smaller newspaper, where he might blossom better on his own. He'd taken the hint and gotten the job with the State Department as a press attaché, a job that paid a decent bureaucratic wage, though without a supergrade's destiny. His official job at the embassy would be to schmooze the elite foreign correspondents of the great American papers and TV networks, granting them access to the ambassador and other embassy officials, and then keeping out of the way while they filed their important stories. His most important job was to appear competent, but little more. Already the local Times correspondent was telling his colleagues that Foley hadn't had the right stuff to make it big as a journalist at America's foremost newspaper, and since he wasn't old enough to teach yet, the other resting place for incompetent reporters, he was doing the next worst thing, being a government puke. It was his job to foster that arrogance, knowing that the KGB would have its people ping on the American press corps for their evaluation of the embassy personnel. The best cover of all for a spook was to be regarded as dull and dim, because the dull and the dim weren't smart enough to be spies. For that, he thanked Ian Fleming and the movies he'd inspired. James Bond was a clever boy, not Ed Foley. No, Ed Foley was a functionary. The crazy part was that the Soviets, whose entire country was governed by dull functionaries, more often than not fell for this story just as readily as if they were someone fresh off the pig farm in Iowa. There was nothing predictable about the espionage business, except here, the station chief told himself. The one thing you could depend on with the Russians was predictability. Everything was written down in some huge book, and everybody here played the game by the book. Foley got aboard the subway car, looking around at his fellow passengers, seeing how they looked at him. His clothing marked him as a foreigner as clearly as a glowing halo marked a saint in a Renaissance painting. "Who are you?" a neutral voice asked, rather to Foley's surprise. "Excuse me," Foley replied in badly accented Russian. "Ah, you are American." "Da, that is so. I work at American Embassy. My first day. I am new in Moscow." Shadow or not, he knew that the only sensible thing was to play this straight. "How do you like it here?" the inquisitor asked. He looked like a bureaucrat. Maybe a KGB counter-espionage spook or a stringer. Or maybe just some officer-sitter for some government-run business who suffered from curiosity. There were some of those. Would an ordinary citizen approach him? Probably not, Foley judged. The atmosphere tended to limit curiosity to the space between a person's ears. Except that Russians were curious as hell about Americans of every stripe. Told to disdain or even to hate Americans, the Russians frequently regarded them as Eve had regarded the apple. "The metro is very impressive," Foley answered, looking around as artlessly as he could. "Where in America do you come from?" was the next question. "New York City." "You play ice hockey in America?" "Oh, yes. I've been a fan of the New York Rangers since I was a child. I want to see the hockey here."
which was entirely truthful. The Russian skate-and-pass game was the closest thing to Mozart in the world of sports. The embassy has good tickets, they told me today. Central Army, he added. Bah, the Muscovite snorted. I am Wings fan. The guy might just be genuine, Foley thought with surprise. The Russians were as picky about their hockey clubs as American baseball fans were with their home teams. But the second chief directorate probably had hockey fans working there, too. Too careful was a concept he did not admit to, especially here. Central Army is the champion team, isn't it? Too prissy. Look what happened to them in America. In America, we play a more physical... Is that the right word? Game. To you, they must seem like hooligans, yes? Foley had taken the train to Philadelphia to see that game. The Flyers, more widely known as the Broad Street Bullies, had beaten the snot out of the somewhat arrogant Russian visitors, rather to his amusement. The Philadelphia team had even wheeled out its secret weapon, the aging Kate Smith singing God Bless America, which for that team was like breakfasting on nails and human infants. Damn what a game that one had been. They play roughly, yes, but they are not fairies. Central Army thinks they are the Bolshoi, the way they skate and pass. It's good to see them humbled sometimes. Well, I remember the 80 Olympics, but honestly, that was a miracle for us to defeat your fine team. Miracle. Bah. Our coach was asleep. Our heroes were asleep. Your children played a spirited game, and they won honestly. The coach needed to be shot. Yeah, this guy talked like a fan. Well, I want my son to learn hockey over here. How old is he? Genuine interest in the man's eyes. 4 and a half. Foley answered. A good age to learn to skate. There are many opportunities for children to skate in Moscow, aren't there, Vanya? He observed to the man next to him, who'd watched the exchange with a mixture of curiosity and unease. Make sure he gets good skates, the other man said. Bad ones can injure the ankles. A typical Russian response. In this often harsh country, solicitude for children was endearingly genuine. The Russian bear had a soft heart for kids, but one of icy granite for adults. Thank you. I will be sure to do that. You live in the foreigner's compound? Correct, Foley confirmed. Next stop is yours. Oh, spasibo, and good day to you. He made his way to the door, turning to nod a friendly goodbye to his newfound Russian friends. KGB, he wondered. Perhaps, but not certainly. He'd determine that by whether or not he saw them on the train a month or so from now. What Ed Foley didn't know was that the entire exchange had been observed by a man a mere 2 meters away, holding a copy of today's Sovietsky Sport. His name was Oleg Zaitsev, and Oleg Ivanovich was KGB. The station chief left the subway car and followed the crush to the escalator. At one time, it would have led him to a full standing portrait of Stalin. But that was gone now, and not replaced. The outside air was acquiring the early autumn chill, just enough to feel good after the stuffiness of the metro. Around him, 10 or more men lit up their foul-smelling cigarettes and walked their separate ways. It was only half a block to the walled compound of apartment blocks, with its guard shack and the uniformed attendant, who looked Foley over and decided he was an American by the quality of his overcoat, without acknowledging his passage by even a nod, and certainly not a smile. The Russians didn't smile much. It was something that struck all American visitors to the country. The outwardly dour nature of the Russian people seemed almost inexplicable to foreigners.
Two stops further down, Oleg Zaitsev wondered if he should write up a contact report. KGB officers were encouraged to do so, partly as a sign of loyalty, partly to show their eternal vigilance against citizens of the main enemy, as America was known within his professional community. It was mostly to show their institutional paranoia, a characteristic openly fostered by KGB. But by profession, Zaitsev was a paper pusher, and he didn't feel the need to generate more meaningless paper. It would just be looked at, read in a cursory way at most, and tossed into some file box by some other bureaucrat from his upstairs office, never to be read again. His time was too precious for that sort of nonsense. Besides, he hadn't even talked to the foreigner, had he? He left the train at the proper stop, rode up the moving stairs into the crisp evening air, lighting his Trude cigarette as he got outside. It was a vile thing. He had access to the closed stores and could have bought French, British, or even American smokes, but they were too costly, and his funds were not as unlimited as his choices. So he smoked the well-known Labor brand, like untold millions of his countrymen. The quality of his clothing was a tiny bit better than that worn by most of his comrades, but not overly so. Not so much that he stood out from the others. It was two blocks to his apartment building. His flat was number 3 on the first. The Americans would have called it the second floor, instead of higher up, and that was fine with him, because it meant that he didn't risk a heart attack if the elevator didn't work, which happened about once a month. Today, it worked. The elderly woman who occupied the janitor superintendent's flat on the ground floor had her door closed today instead of open to denote some mechanical problem she'd have to warn him about. So nothing in the building was broken today. Not quite cause for celebration, just one of the small things in life for which to be grateful to God, or whoever determined the vagaries of fate. The cigarette died as he walked in the main door. Zaitsev flicked the butt into the ashtray and walked to the elevator, which remarkably was waiting for him, with the door open.
"Good evening, Comrade Zaitsev," the operator said in greeting.
"Good evening, Comrade Glenko." The man was a disabled veteran of the Great Patriotic War, with the medals to prove it. Artilleryman, so he said. Probably the building informer, the man who reported unusual occurrences to some other KGB stringer, in return for which he got a niggardly stipend to supplement whatever pension the Red Army paid him. That was the extent of their exchange. Glenko turned the handle and brought the elevator car smoothly to his floor and opened the door. From there it was a mere 5 meters to his home. Opening his apartment door, he was greeted by the smell of boiling cabbage. So, cabbage soup for dinner. Not unusual. It was a staple of the Russian diet, along with rich black bread.
"Papa!"
Oleg Ivanovich bent down to scoop up his little Svetlana. She was the light of Zaitsev's life, with her cherubic face and welcoming smile.
"How is my little Zaitchik today?"
He scooped her up in his arms and accepted her darling little kiss. Svetlana attended a daycare center crowded with other children her age. Not quite a preschool, not quite a nursery. Her clothing comprised about the only colorful things to be had in his country, in this case a green pullover shirt and gray pants over little red leather shoes. If his access to the closed shops had one advantage, it was in what he could get his little girl. The Soviet Union didn't even have cloth diapers for its infants. Mothers usually made them out of old bedsheets, much less the disposable kind favored in the West. As a result, there was a premium on getting the little one's toilet trained, which little Svetlana had managed some time ago, much to her mother's relief. Oleg followed the smell of cabbage to his wife in the kitchen.
"Hello, darling," Irina Bogdanova said from the stove.
Cabbage, potatoes, and what he hoped was some ham cooking.
tea and bread. No vodka yet. The Zaitsevs drank, but not to excess. They usually waited until Svetlana went down to bed. Irina worked as an accountant at the gum department store. The possessor of a degree from Moscow State University, she was liberated in the Western sense, but not emancipated. Hanging by the kitchen table was the string bag she carried in her purse everywhere she went, eyes always on the lookout for something she might buy to eat or brighten their drab flat. It meant standing in line, which was the task of women in the Soviet Union, along with cooking dinner for her man, regardless of his professional status in life or hers. She knew that he worked for state security, but did not know his job there, just that it paid a fairly comfortable salary, and came with a uniform that he rarely wore, and a rank soon to take a jump upward. So whatever he did it well enough, she judged, and that was sufficient. The daughter of an infantryman in the Great Patriotic War, she'd gone to state schools and gotten above-average marks, but never quite achieved what she'd wished. She'd shown some talent at the piano, but not enough to go onward to a state conservatory. She'd also tried her hand at writing, but there, too, she'd fallen short of the necessary talent to get published. Not an unattractive woman, she was thin by Russian standards. Her mouse-brown hair fell to her shoulders and was usually well brushed out. She read a good deal, whichever books she could get that were worth her time, and enjoyed listening to classical music. She and her husband occasionally attended concerts at the Tchaikovsky. Oleg preferred the ballet, and so they went there as well, helped, Irina assumed, by his job at No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square. He was not yet so senior as to allow them to hobnob with senior state security officials at comradely parties. Perhaps when he got his colonelcy, she hoped. For the moment, they lived the middle-class life of state-employed bureaucrats, scratching by on their combined salaries. The good news was that they had occasional access to the closed KGB stores, where at least they could buy nice things for her and Svetlana. And who knew? Maybe they could afford to have another child in due course. They were both young enough, and a little boy would brighten their home. "Anything interesting today?" she asked. It was almost their daily joke. "There is never anything interesting at the office," he joked in reply. "No, just the usual messages to and from field officers, which he forwarded to the appropriate pigeonholes for in-house couriers to hand carry upstairs to the offices of the control officers, who really ran things at KGB. A very senior colonel had come down to see the operation the previous week, which he'd done without a smile, a friendly word, or a question for 20 minutes, before disappearing off to the elevator banks. Oleg knew the man's seniority only from the identity of his escort, the colonel who ran his own operation. Whatever words had been exchanged had been too distant for him to overhear. People tended to talk in whispers, if at all, in his department, and he was trained not to show much interest. But training could only go so far. Captain Oleg Ivanovich Zaitsev was too bright to turn his mind all the way off. Indeed, his job required something approaching judgment for its proper execution, but that was something to be exercised as gingerly as a mouse's stroll through a roomful of cats. He always went to his immediate superior and always started off with the most humble of questions before getting approval. In fact, his judgmental questions were always approved. Oleg was gifted in that, and he was beginning to get recognized as such. His majority wasn't all that far off. More money, more access to the closed stores, and gradually more independence. No, that wasn't quite right. A little less circumscription on what he would be able to do. Someday he might even ask if a message going out made good sense. "Do we really want to do this, comrade?" he'd wanted to ask every so often.
Operational decisions were not his to make, of course, but he could, or would be able to in the future, question the wording of a directive in the most oblique terms. Every so often he'd see something going out to Officer 457 in Rome, for example, and wonder if his country really wanted to risk the consequences of having the mission order go bad. And sometimes they did go bad. Just 2 months before, he'd seen a dispatch from Bonn warning that something had gone wrong with the West German counterintelligence service, and the field officer had urgently requested instructions. And the instructions had been to continue his mission without questioning the intelligence of his superiors. And that field officer had disappeared right off the network. Arrested and shot? Oleg wondered. He knew some of the field officers' names, virtually all of the operations' names, and a lot of the operational targets and objectives. Most of all, he knew the code names of hundreds of foreign nationals who were agents of the KGB. At its best, it could be like reading a spy novel. Some of the field officers had a literary streak. Their dispatches were not the terse communiques of military officers. No, they liked to communicate the state of mind of their agents, the feel of the information and the mission assigned. They could be like travelogue writers describing things for a paying audience. Zaitsev wasn't really supposed to digest such information, but he was a man with a mind, and besides, there were telltale codes built into every dispatch. The third word misspelled, for example, could be a warning that the officer had been compromised. Every officer had a different such key system, and Zaitsev had a list of them all. Only twice had he caught such irregularities, and on one of those occasions his supervisors had told him to ignore it as a clerical error, a fact that still astounded him. But the mistake had never been repeated. And so maybe it really had just been an enciphering error by the officer in question. After all, his superior had told him, men trained at the center didn't often get caught in the field. They were the best in the world, and the Western enemies were not that clever, were they? Then Captain Zaitsev had nodded submission to the moment, written down his warning notation, and made sure it was in the permanent files, covering his ass like any good bureaucrat. What if his immediate superior were under the control of some Western spy agency, he'd wondered at the time, and later on, usually after a few drinks in front of his TV set? Such a compromise would be perfection itself. Nowhere in KGB was there a single written list of their officers and agents. No. Compartmentalization was a concept invented here back in the 1920s, or perhaps earlier still. Even Chairman Andropov was not allowed to have such a thing within his reach, lest he defect to the West and take it with him. KGB trusted no one, least of all its own chairman. And so, oddly, only people in his own department had access to such broad information, but they were not operations personnel. They were just communicators. But wasn't the one person KGB always tried to compromise the cipher clerk in a foreign embassy? Because he or she was the one functionary, the one not bright enough to be entrusted with anything of importance. Wasn't she the one person who was so entrusted? It was so often a woman, after all, and KGB officers were trained to seduce them. He'd seen dispatches along those lines, some of them describing the seduction in graphic detail, perhaps to impress the men upstairs with their manly prowess and the extent of their devotion to the state. Being paid to fuck women didn't strike Zaitsev as conspicuously heroic, but then perhaps the women were surpassingly ugly, and performing a man's duty under such circumstances might have been difficult. What it came down to, Oleg Ivanovich reflected, was that functionaries were so often entrusted with cosmic secrets, and he was one of them. And wasn't that amusing? More amusing than his cabbage soup, certainly, nutritious though it might be. So even the Soviet state trusted some people, despite the fact that trust was a concept as divorced from its way of collective thinking as a man is from Mars. And he was such a man. Well, one result of that irony was the cute green shirt his little daughter wore. He set out a few books on the kitchen chair and hoisted Svetlana there so that she could eat her dinner. Svetlana's hands were a little small for the zinc aluminum tableware, but at least it wasn't too heavy for her to use. He still had to butter her bread for her. It was good to be able to afford real butter. "I saw something nice at the special store on the way home," Irina observed, as women do over dinner, to catch their husband in a good mood. The cabbage was especially good today, and the ham was Polish. So she'd shopped today at the closed store, all right. She'd gotten into the habit only 9 months before, and now she wondered aloud how she'd ever lived without it. "What's that?" Oleg asked, sipping his Georgian tea. "Braziers. Swedish ones." Oleg smiled. Those of Soviet manufacture always seemed to be designed for peasant girls who suckled calves instead of children, far too big for a woman of his wife's more human proportions. "How much?" he asked, without looking up. "Only 17 rubles each." 17 certificate rubles, he didn't correct her. A certificate ruble had actual value. You could, theoretically, even exchange it for a foreign hard currency, as opposed to the valueless paper which they used to pay the average factory worker, whose value was entirely theoretical. Like everything else in his country when you got down to it. "What color?"
"White."
Perhaps the special store had black or red ones, but it was a rare Soviet woman who would wear such things. People were very conservative in their habits here. With dinner finished, Oleg left the kitchen to his wife and took his little girl into the living room and the TV set. The TV news announced that the harvest was underway, as it was every year, with the heroic laborers on the collective farms bringing in the first crop of summer wheat in the northern areas, where they had to grow and harvest it quickly. "A fine crop," the TV said. Good, Oleg thought. No bread shortages this winter. Probably. You could never really be sure about what was said on the TV. Next, some complaining coverage of the American nuclear weapons being deployed in the NATO countries, despite the reasonable Soviet requests that the West forego such unnecessary, destabilizing, and provocative actions. Zaitsev knew that the Soviet SS-20s were going into place elsewhere, and they, of course, were in no way destabilizing. The big show on TV tonight was We Serve the Soviet Union, about military operations, fine young Soviet men serving their country. Today would be rare coverage of men doing their international duty in Afghanistan. The Soviet media didn't often cover that, and Oleg was curious as to what they'd show. There were occasional discussions over lunch at work about the war in Afghanistan. He tended to listen rather than talk because he'd been excused from military service, something he didn't regret one little bit. He'd heard too many stories about the casual brutality in the infantry units, and besides, the uniforms were not attractive to wear. His rarely worn KGB uniform was bad enough. Still, pictures told stories that mere words did not, and he had the keen eye for detail that his job required. You know, every year they harvest wheat in Kansas, and it never makes the NBC nightly news, Ed Foley said to his wife. I suppose feeding themselves is a major accomplishment, Mary Pat observed. How's the office? Small. Then he waved his hands in such a way as to say that nothing interesting had happened. Soon she'd have to drive their car around to check for alert signals. They were working Agent Cardinal here in Moscow, and he was their most important assignment. The colonel knew that he'd have new handlers here. Setting that arrangement up would be touchy, but Mary Pat was accustomed to handling the touchy ones. Chapter 4 Introductions. It was 5 in the evening in London and noon in Langley when Ryan lit up his secure phone to call home. He'd have to get used to the time zones. Like a lot of people, he found that his creative times of day tended to divide themselves into two parts. Mornings were best for digesting information, but later afternoons were better for contemplation. Admiral Greer tended to be the same way, and so Jack would find himself disconnected from his boss's work routine, which wasn't good. He also had to get used to the mechanics of handling documents. He'd been in government service long enough to know that it would never be as easy as he expected, nor as simple as it ought to be. "Greer," a voice said after the secure link was established. "Ryan here, sir." "How's England, Jack?" "Haven't seen it rain yet. Kathy starts a new job tomorrow morning." "How's Basil?" "I can't complain about the hospitality, sir." "Where are you now?" "Century House. They gave me an office on the top floor with a guy in their Russian section." "I bet you want an STU for your home." "Good call, sir." The old bastard was pretty good at reading minds. "What else?" "Nothing comes immediately to mind, Admiral." "Anything interesting yet?" "Just settling in, sir." "The Russian section looks smart. The guy I'm working with, Simon Harding, reads the tea leaves pretty well," Ryan said, glad that Simon was off at the moment. "Of course, maybe the phone was bugged." "Nah. Not for a knight commander of the Victorian Order." Or would they? "Kid's okay?" "Yes, sir. Sally's trying to figure out the local TV." "Kids adapt pretty well. Better than adults do." "I'll let you know, Admiral." "The Hopkins document ought to be on your desk tomorrow." "Thanks. I think they'll like it. Bernie said some interesting things." "This other thing with the Pope. What are our cousins saying?" "They're concerned." "So am I. I think His Holiness has rattled their cage pretty hard, and I think Ivan's going to notice." "What's Basil saying?" "Not much. I do not know what assets they have on site. I imagine they're waiting to see what they can find out." Jack paused. "Anything from our end?" "Not yet," was the terse reply. It was a step up from "nothing I can talk to you about." "Does Admiral Greer really trust me now?" Jack wondered. Sure, Greer liked him, but did he really trust him to be a good analyst? Perhaps this London sojourn was, if not boot camp, then maybe a second trip through the basic school. That was where the Marine Corps made sure that young men with lieutenant's bars really had the right stuff to lead Marines in the field. It was reputed to be the hardest school in the Corps. It hadn't been especially easy for Ryan, but he had graduated at the top of his class. Maybe he'd just been lucky. He hadn't served long enough to find out, courtesy of a broken CH-46 over the island of Crete, an event that still visited him in the occasional nightmare. Fortunately, his gunnery sergeant and a Navy corpsman had stabilized him, but Jack still got a chill even thinking about helicopters. "Tell me what you think, Jack. If my job were to keep the Pope alive, I'd be a little nervous. The Russians can play rough when they want to. What I cannot evaluate is how the Politburo might react. I mean, how much starch they might have in their backbone. When I talked to Basil, I said it comes down to how scared they are by his threat. If you call it a threat." "What would you call it, Jack?" the DDI asked from 3,400 miles away. "Yes, sir, you have me there. I suppose it is a threat of sorts to their way of thinking." "Of sorts? How does it look to them?" Jim Greer would have been one tough son of a bitch teaching graduate-level history or political science. Right up there with Father Tim at Georgetown. Noted, Admiral. It's a threat, and they will see it as such. I am not sure, however, how serious a threat they will take it to be. It's not as though they believe in God. To them, God is politics, and politics is just a process, not a belief system as we understand the term. Jack, you need to learn to see reality through the eyes of your adversary. Your analytical ability is first rate, but you have to work on perception. This isn't stocks and bonds, where you dealt with hard numbers, not perceptions of numbers. They say El Greco had astigmatism in his eyes that gave everything a visual slant. They see reality through a different lens, too. If you can replicate that, you'll be one of the best around, but you have to make that leap of imagination. Harding's pretty good at that. Learn from him to see the inside of their heads. You know Simon? Jack asked. I've been reading his analyses for years. None of this is an accident, Jack, he told himself, with more surprise than there ought to have been. His second important lesson of the day. Understood, sir. Don't sound too surprised, my boy. Aye, aye, sir, Ryan responded like a marine shavetail. I won't make that mistake again, Admiral. And in that moment, John Patrick Ryan became a real intelligence analyst. I'll have the embassy deliver the STU to you. You know about keeping it secure, the DDI added as a cautionary note. Yes, sir, I can do that. Good. Lunchtime here. Yes, sir. Talk to you tomorrow. Ryan replaced the receiver in the cradle and then extracted the plastic key from the slot in the phone set. That went into his pocket. He checked his watch. Time to close up shop. He'd already cleared his desk of classified folders. A woman came around about 4:30 with a shopping cart to take them back to Central Records Storage. Right on cue, Simon came back in. What time's your train? 6:10. Time for a beer, Jack. Interested? Works for me, Simon. He rose and followed his roommate out the door. It was only a 4-minute walk to the Fox and Cock, a very traditional pub a block from Century House. A little too traditional. It looked like a relic from Shakespeare's time, with massive wooden timbers and plaster walls. It had to be for architectural effect. No real building could have survived that long, could it? Inside was a cloud of tobacco smoke and a lot of people wearing jackets and ties. Clearly an upscale pub. A lot of the patrons were probably from Century House. Harding confirmed it. It's our watering hole. The publican used to be one of us. Probably makes more here than he ever did at the shop. Without being bidden, Harding ordered 2 pints of Tetley's bitter, which arrived quickly. Then he ushered Jack to a corner booth. So, Sir John, how do you like it here? No complaints so far. He took a sip. Admiral Greer thinks you're pretty smart. And Basil thinks he's rather bright as well. Good chap to work for, Harding asked. Yeah, big time. He listens and helps you think. Doesn't stomp on you when you goof. He'd rather teach than embarrass you. Well, that's my experience anyway. Some of the more senior analysts have had him tear a stripe off their ass. I guess I'm not senior enough for that yet. Ryan paused. You supposed to be my training officer over here, Simon? The directness of the question surprised his host. I wouldn't say that, exactly. I'm a Soviet specialist. You're more a generalist, I take it. Try apprentice, Ryan suggested. Very well. What do you want to know? How to think like a Russian? Harding laughed into his beer.
That's something we all learn every day. The key is to remember that, to them, everything is politics, and politics, remember, is all about nebulous ideas, aesthetics, especially in Russia, Jack. They can't deliver real products like automobiles and television sets, so they have to concentrate on everything fitting into their political theory, the sayings of Marx and Lenin. And, of course, Lenin and Marx knew sod all about doing real things in the real world. It's like a religion gone mad. But instead of thunderbolts or biblical plagues, they kill their apostates with firing squads. In their world outlook, everything that goes wrong is the result of political apostasy. Their political theory ignores human nature. And since their political theory is holy writ, and therefore is never wrong, it must be human nature that's wrong. It's not logically consistent, you see. Ever study metaphysics? Boston College, second year. The Jesuits make you spend a semester on it, Ryan confirmed, taking a long sip. Whether you want to or not. Well, communism is metaphysics applied ruthlessly to the real world. And when things don't fit, it's the fault of the square sods who don't fit into their round, bloody holes. That can be rather hard on the poor sods, you see. And so, Joe Stalin murdered roughly 20 million of them, partly because of political theory, partly because of his own mental illness and bloody-mindedness. That insane bugger defined paranoia. One pays a price for being ruled by a madman with a twisted book of rules, you see. But how faithful is the current political leadership to Marxist theory? A thoughtful nod. That's the question, Jack. The answer is, we don't bloody know. They all claim to be true believers, but are they? Harding paused for a contemplative sip of his own. Only when it suits them, I think. But that depends on who one is talking about. Suslov, for example, believes totally. But the rest of them? To some greater or lesser extent, they do and they don't. I suppose you can characterize them as people who used to go to church every Sunday, then fell away from the habit. Part of them still believes, but some greater or lesser part does not. What they do believe in is the fact that the state religion is the source of their power and status. And so, for all the common folk out there, they must appear to believe, because believing is the only thing that gives them that power and status. Intellectual inertia? Ryan wondered aloud. Exactly, Jack. Newton's first law of motion. Part of Ryan wanted to object to the discourse. The world had to make more sense than that. But did it? What rules said that it had to? He asked himself. And who enforced such rules? And was it expressed that simply? What Harding had just explained in less than 200 words purported to justify hundreds of billions of dollars in expenditures, strategic weapons of incomprehensible power, and millions of people whose uniforms denoted enmity that demanded aggression and death in time of war or near war. But the world was about ideas, good and bad, and the conflict between this one and Ryan's own defined the reality in which Ryan worked, defined the belief system of the people who'd tried to kill him and his family. And that was as real as it had to be, wasn't it? No, there was no rule that compelled the world to make sense. People decided on their own what made sense and what did not. So, was everything about the world a matter of perception? Was it all a thing of the mind? What was reality? But that was the question behind all of metaphysics.
When Ryan had studied it at Boston College, it had been so purely theoretical that it seemed to have no attachment at all to reality. It had been a lot for Ryan to absorb at age 19, and, he realized, just as much to absorb at age 32. But here, the marks were often recorded in human blood, not on a report card. Christ, Simon. You know, it would be a lot easier if they did believe in God. Then, Jack, it would be just another religious war, and those are bloody affairs, too, you may recall. Think of it as the Crusades. One version of God against another. Those wars were quite nasty enough. The true believers in Moscow think that they are riding the wave of history, that they are bringing perfection to the human condition. It must drive them mad when they see that their own country can scarcely feed itself, and so they try to ignore it. But it is difficult to ignore an empty belly, isn't it? So they blame it all on us and on wreckers, traitors and saboteurs in their own country. Those are the people they imprison or kill. Harding shrugged. Personally, I regard them as infidels, believers in a false god. It's just easier that way. I've studied their political theology, but that has limited value because, as I said, so many of them do not really believe in the substance of their system. Sometimes they think like tribal Russians, whose outlook on the world has always been skewed by our standards. Russian history is such a muddle that studying it has its own limits in terms of Western logic. They're xenophobes of a very high order, always have been, but for fairly reasonable historical causes. They've always had threats from both East and West. The Mongols, for example, have been as far west as the Baltic, and the Germans and French have hammered on the gates of Moscow. As we say, they're a rum lot. One thing I do know is that no sane man wants them as masters. A pity, really. They have so many marvelous poets and composers. Flowers in a junkyard, Ryan suggested. Exactly, Jack. Very good. Harding fished for his pipe and lit it with a kitchen match. So, how do you like the beer? Excellent. Much better than at home. I don't know how you Americans can stomach it. But your beef is better than ours. Corn-fed. Turns out better meat than grass does, Ryan sighed. I'm still getting used to life over here. Every time I start feeling comfortable, something hits me like a snake in high grass. Well, you've had less than a week to get used to us. My kids will be talking funny. Civilized, Jack. Civilized, Harding observed with a good laugh. You Yanks do ravage our language, you know. Yeah, right. Pretty soon he'd refer to baseball as rounders, which was a girls' game over here. They didn't know dick about a good fastball. For his part, Ed Foley found himself suddenly outraged by the bugs that he knew had to be in his apartment. Every time he made love to his wife, some KGB desk weenie was listening in. Probably a nice, perverse diversion for their counter-espionage spooks, but it was, by God, the Foley's love life, and was nothing sacred? He and Mary Pat had been briefed in on what to expect, and his wife had actually joked about it on the flight over. You couldn't bug airplanes. She'd called it a way of showing those barbarians how real people lived, and he'd laughed. But here and now, it wasn't so goddamn funny. It was like being an animal in a goddamn zoo, with people watching and laughing and pointing. Would KGB keep a log of how often he and his wife got it on? They might, he thought, looking for marital difficulties as a pretext for recruiting him or Mary Pat. Everyone did it. So they'd have to make love regularly just to discourage that possibility, though playing a reverse false flag did have interesting theoretical possibilities of its own. No, the station chief decided. It'd be an unnecessary complication for their stay in Moscow, and being chief of station was already complex enough. Only the ambassador, the defense attaché, and his own officers were allowed to know who he was. Ron Fielding was the overt COS, and his job was to wiggle like a good worm on the hook. When parking his car, he'd occasionally leave his sun visor down or rotated 90 degrees. Sometimes he'd wear a flower in his buttonhole and take it out halfway down a block as though signaling someone, or, best of all, he'd bump into people, simulating a brush pass. That sort of thing could make the second chief directorate counter-spooks go nuts. Race after innocent Muscovites, perhaps snatch a few up for interrogations, or put a squad of officers on the poor random bastard to watch everything he did. If nothing else, it forced KGB to waste assets on fool's errands, chasing after phantom geese. Best of all, it persuaded them that Fielding was a clumsy station chief. It always made the other side feel good, and that was always a smart move for CIA. The game he played made other power moves look like a game of chutes and ladders. But the fact that there were probably bugs in his bedroom pissed him off. And he couldn't do the usual things to contravene them, like playing the radio and talking under it. No, he couldn't act like a trained spook. He had to be dumb, and playing dumb required brains and discipline and the utmost thoroughness. Not a single mistake was allowed. That one mistake could get people killed, and Ed Foley had a conscience. It was a dangerous thing for a field spook to have, but it was impossible not to have. You had to care about your agents, those foreign nationals who worked for you and fed you information. All, well, nearly all, had problems. The big one here was alcoholism. He expected every agent he ran into to be a boozer. Some were quite mad. Most were people